You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me, that's why you hear the Michigan music. He was our first guest when we started very graciously. And now, over a year later, joining us again is the Commandant of the Marine Corps, Bob Neller. First of all, sir, good morning. Thanks for doing this.
Good to see you, Mac. Good to talk to you again.
All right. Before we get going in the interview proper, would you like it to take the opportunity to apologize for the conduct of the Detroit Tigers yesterday?
You know, I watched the film, and quite frankly, I was appalled. I was appalled at the sucker punch number 24 the Yankees put on Miguel Cabrera. And, you know, Cabrera gets hit. You know, he gets hit fair and square.
No, he didn't get hit. They missed him. They missed his fat ass.
He hit him in the butt.
The one that
really upset me is when the guy threw at the guy's head. That was, you know, okay, so Sanchez gets a home run. He takes one in the butt. Cabrera comes up the next inning. He takes one. Okay, and he gets in a discussion. The umpire turned his back, and, you know, so they got into it. Okay, that's baseball. But the one that's just totally wrong is when the Yankee guy threw at the guy's head.
He said he didn't mean to. He said he didn't mean to. It was an accident.
He's a major league pitcher. That's so lame. I mean, the Tigers are bad enough. They don't need anybody getting hit in the head.
So I take it that you're not going to apologize to the Tigers.
For the Tigers?
Yes.
No, I'm proud of them for fighting, being in last place and fighting. Never quit.
All right.
Never quit.
That didn't go exactly.
I'm going to Detroit in a couple of weeks. I'm going to the game.
Are you?
And I'm praying that Al Kaline will be there and I can meet my hero.
You've never met him?
I've never met him.
Man. He was, you know, I'll tell you what, he was a, you know, as a player, there was something about him. Guys like him and Stan, I remember Stan Musial, but I remember, I was 10 years old, the A's and the Tigers had this thing that started in the minor leagues, and my dad, I went to the capital of the Confederacy in Montgomery when it was first initiated, my dad was managing the Birmingham A's, and my mom made him take me on a road trip to Montgomery, and that was the Tigers minor league team. And at the time, the Tigers minor league team had Willie Horton, Bill Freehan, Mickey Stanley, all these guys that would come up and be with the great Tiger teams, and they got in a fight in the minor leagues. And then it spilled on. I remember watching them fight in Oakland in Blue Moon Odom. A guy named Jack Aker hit Jim Northrup in the head, and Northrup went down. He got up, and he went straight to the mound, and they had a fight that, and they were still fighting. Campanera still threw the bat at what's-his-face in the playoffs years later, and that was like the fourth fight that those guys had. So why, I mean, I don't know
you
why.
Know, I wouldn't mess with Freehan, you know. He was like a wrestler in Michigan.
No, they had a big team. Norm Cash?
Horton was a big dude, too.
Gates Brown had got out of prison.
Gates Brown. He's one of the best pinch hitters of all time.
Of all time. No, the Tigers were tough. Yep. All right, let me ask you some serious questions. We've watched the Navy over the course of the last 2 months go through some pretty tough times. Being a service head and doing crisis leadership, you did the same thing relative to the incidents at Parris Island and the Marines United stuff. We all watched you testify in front of members of Congress. What do you try to do when you have social media, politicians, news headlines, the tsunami coming at you? What do you do? How do you handle all that?
Well, we addressed the problem as directly as we could. I was criticized probably fairly for not. I knew it was a problem when this guy, Brennan, came to us with the Marines United. I knew it was wrong, and this is not a new problem, but there's a lot of stuff that comes your way every day. But I would tell you that, you know, at the hearing and the press conference and all that, it did a number of things positive for me. One, I think everybody knew who the commandant was. I think second, I think rightly or wrongly, maybe people saw how I addressed the questions from some of the hard questions from some of the members. Third, I think it made a lot of them, I think a lot of Marines got upset about it. They saw me up there taking it for them, which is fine. That's my job. I told everybody as I traveled around and talked about this, probably, I don't know how many thousands of Marines, hey, look, that's my job. This is the battle space I operate in. And I'm the advocate for you. And so if we make a mistake, if we do good, you get the credit. If we make a mistake, it's on me. And then the last one I think that happened that was good is that it clarified for me what the real issue was. The real issue, I mean, the symptom is the way we behave on social media. The real issue is how we men see women in our Marine Corps. And the answer is not 100%, but I think it runs from hostily to indifferently. I got a long email from a Marine gunner friend of mine after I went down to Lejeune and talked to everybody, and he goes, I heard what you said. I feel bad that you have to take this for everybody, but hey, that's my job. He said, but you know, I don't do social media and all that, but now that I'm more senior as an infantry Marine and I've been exposed to women in our Marine Corps, I realize I've been wrong all these years, and if I'm guilty of anything, I'm guilty of being indifferent to their plight. And I use that line because I think 90% of the Marine Corps is men. And it's, I mean, why do you got to pick on 10%? Let them do their job. Let them do their job. We discriminate all the time. You always discriminate against people that can perform and not perform, and that's fair. But to discriminate based on gender or ethnicity as the total basis for that is, it's just wrong. We got to be better than that. And I think my job has been to raise everybody's conscience into that. We'll see. We'll see if people listen. There's a lot of acrimony in the country now about this stuff. And we've got to be an example for the rest of the nation on how to be Americans.
Where's the Marine United investigation today? I mean, I think a lot of us are waiting to see. I mean,
Well, it's ongoing. I mean, we formed a group of an organization, and we monitor. I get a report every week of people who are reported for misconduct on social media. Some weeks there's none. Last week there were three. There are a couple recent special court martials of Marines who took pictures of other Marines without their permission, and they were reported, and they got bad paper and confinement. That's the process. I'm not going to comment on that. And
right.
There is, you know, there are going to be those that say that, you know, there's not enough accountability. There are always going to be say that we're overreacting.
Right.
We're going to let the process so that everybody knows the rules. I mean, there's change the sex manual. There's violation of Article 120, Article 134. I mean, the question I would ask is, do you have anything better to do with your time? I mean, with all the stuff going on in the world with North Korea and Russia, the big exercise, the pod going on. I mean, the world is in a very unsettled, unstable place. The probability for military conflict is probably as high as it's been since you and I have been on this earth. And I would like to think that we would be spending our time focused on how to get ready to go to war, making ourselves better individually, making ourselves more fit, more smart, better trained, better educated, better teammate, rather than doing stuff that you would expect somebody that doesn't wear the title U.S. Marine be involved in. But that's the challenge.
Can you give us some sense of, from the investigation, how many guys were initially in that, when that thing exploded, how many guys on active duty were a part of it? Because there were so many different reports. It's like you didn't know.
I don't know the number. I mean, there were allegedly 30,000 people that had joined the Marines United webpage to do what the Marines United was supposed to do, which was help folks that had been in the fight,
right,
stay connected, get help, get jobs, go to school, deal, you know, just maintain a relationship. And I think we've learned that, and we've known this for years from all other wars. I mean, that's why all the folks came back from World War II and they joined the American Legion or the VFW.
Right.
That's how they stayed connected with their friends, and that's how they dealt with whatever issues. And they were brought back properly. Korea, maybe a little less so. Vietnam, certainly, and were not properly greeted and returned as society by the American people. But so the Marines United, social media is a way people stay connected. They don't go to the BFW. They don't go down to Legion like they used to.
Right.
And there's reasons for that, families or whatever. But, you know, I've heard, you know, there were allegedly, Mr. Brennan told us there were about 500 that were in this subset that were, you know, presenting pictures. How many of them were doing the other stuff? I don't know the exact number. How many of them were active duty? I could get you that, but I don't. Right. Quite frankly, to me, it's irrelevant. If there was one Marine on there doing that, then that's of concern to us, and then because we can't accept that kind of behavior.
Okay.
So recently, Marines United has morphed multiple times. It came back up as a website called MU. And they've said on their webpage they had like 1,700 members. How many of those are active duty? You know, we continue to chase them around. Quite frankly, as I told Marines, I mean, I actually got better stuff to do on their behalf than to be, and we don't have the time or the wherewithal to be the social media police. But I think the majority of these folks, if not all of them, that are not active duty, if they are active duty, then they're accepting some risk.
Got it.
And I would ask them to reconsider what benefit they see this brings themselves personally and their family, and certainly what benefit it brings to the United States Marine Corps.
No, I mean, when I think about it, the saying that booms through my head is a sergeant major saying that I heard for the first time when I was a lieutenant. I can fix a lot of things, but I can't fix stupid. And it is stupid. I had people email me questions that they, you know, that they wanted me to pose to you, and I'll ask you one here. Do you think officers and staff NCOs should be encouraged to have Facebook and Twitter accounts because that's how their Marines communicate these days? And I saw in your testimony you said you weren't familiar with social media because you don't do it. Do you think they should be encouraged simply to understand this is the battlefield, this is where your Marines are, you ought to at least be familiar with it?
What I said was I don't personally participate. I participate in the course of my duties as the commandant. I've got a Twitter account and we have a Facebook account, and I use that, just as you stated, to communicate with Marines.
Right.
I think if I were a staff NCO or a company grade officer today, I would be on social media and I would ask the Marines that I was responsible for to friend me so that I could see what they're doing. Or I could use it as a means of communication. I don't think that substitutes, however, for standing in formation and talking to people like you and I are used to. And that's the one thing about it. So I think it's a good idea.
Okay.
I think that's a way to see what's going on in somebody's life. Because for some reason, people, if they're having some stress or whatever in their life, or they're getting ready to do something foolish, or they're in foolish behavior, they like to post, and I think that's a way to head some of this stuff off. Break. But that doesn't substitute for taking the time as a human being. I think we're a little bit more than just a carbon life form to sit down and talk to each other. So if you looked at the new Marine Corps Leader Development Program, that's really focused on directing leaders to, during certain portions or certain times in the year, in the life of a Marine that you're responsible for, you're supposed to sit down and talk to them. And it even gives you these six areas you should focus on, whether, you know, fighter, their competence in their MOS, their fidelity, their future, their finance, their family, and their fitness. Six Fs. And we just kind of, it's easier to remember. We bend it that way on purpose. That's not a new concept. My only concern is if we, you know, we got to do more than just communicate on social media. We actually have to talk to each other because we're humans,
right.
And we need to have conversation. And it doesn't come across the same way when you're texting or you're using a post than it is when you and I sit across from each other and we look each other in the eye.
Got it.
Share a conversation about something important.
Let me ask you for a short answer here. What two issues, as you walk into work today, what two Marine Corps issues concern you the most?
Well, I think day-to-day, I think the overall readiness of the force, equipment readiness, and the manning of units, the training of units, all the stuff that goes into readiness that you're familiar with.
Right.
And I think, just overall readiness. I always, you know, we have, every day I get the report of kind of where everybody is and what they're doing, and we get the kind of behavioral stuff every day. I get the stuff from the joint staff. Here's where everybody is, here's what's going on, here's what other nations have going on, and here's where Marines are and what they're doing. And there's some folks out there that are they're prepared and they're trained, but they're in some risk. There's some risk in where they are. I think the thing that other than the overall readiness of the force, and, you know, there's certain other things. Like right now, we're getting ready to close out the fiscal year. We want to make sure we spend all our money. We're watching what's going on with Congress. But I just think the thing that I struggle with is just kind of the things that I'm sure, like the CNO. I mean, we can't get, you know, the enemy doesn't even have to worry about doing bad stuff to us because we're too busy doing it to ourselves. I mean, I think the SecNav was down. He goes, hey, we can't get out of our own way. I mean, the enemy doesn't have to destroy our gear. We manage to do it ourselves. And I'm not speaking ill of the dead. I would never do that. Sometimes, you know, things happen and you have a bad day.
Right.
But all the stuff that Marines do, I know it's not their intent to wreck on a motorcycle or wreck in a car or do something. But it's kind of like what you said, the Sergeant Major said, I can't control, you know, people making mistakes or doing unnecessarily risky things. And that's the thing that every day I just like, when is it going to stop? We got really good people. We've always had, you know, good people in the Marine Corps. Men and women that want to sacrifice and earn the title. And earning the title is just the first step. I mean, it gets harder after that.
Right.
We can't stop. But that's to get in the door. Then it gets hard. Now we want more. And I'm frustrated and struggle with why so many young men and women are doing stuff that don't facilitate their success either as a Marine or for the rest of their life.
You had the occasion to host the president of South Korea on his first trip to the United States. The first official visit that he made was to the National Museum of the Marine Corps. I had General Rusty Blackman on. I asked him, I said, hey, sir, has the cathedral, as I call it, has it surpassed even your expectations? And he said, we had lofty expectations, but it has. It has become more special than we thought it would become. It is moving beyond what we thought it would be. And he said that visit was emblematic of something that we could not have foreseen, but was special, and there was no better place for him to visit than the National Museum of the Marine Corps. You were there that day, yes?
Yes, sir.
What was that like? I mean, I would argue that may be one the Marine Corps' finest hour of a lot of fine hours. But
well, I think you got to put it in context. So you got to understand why President Moon came there with his wife and his entourage. I mean, he landed in Andrews, and the first place he came was there. You know, his parents, you know the history of the Chosun. Actually, the Koreans don't like the word Chosun. Chosun is the Japanese pronunciation for that body of water. They call it Chongjin. But the maps we had were Japanese maps. So that's why we call it Chosun Reservoir. Aguru-ri and Kodo-ri. So the story that most people don't know is that when the Marines fought their way out of there, surrounded by X number of Chinese divisions and basically slaughtered them, we brought with us a whole bunch of Koreans, refugees. We brought them with us to the beach because they came with us. And if you read that some of the difficulties that, you know, the one road up and one road back part of the time was clobbered by refugees. Moon's parents were in that group. Well, his parents got put on a Navy ship down there at Wonsan when they backloaded out of there. And we took his parents to freedom. We, Marines, United States Navy, took his parents to freedom. And it was on Christmas Day. And he said his parents remembered that Marines walked around, or the people of the ship's company or somebody, some American gave them all. You know, they didn't have much for food, but there was like a two-day trip, but they tried to feed them. They chock-a-blocked the ship with refugees, and everybody, it was Christmas, gave everybody a piece of candy, something to eat. So his story was, that's what his story was. Hey, I wouldn't be here as the president of the Republic of South Korea if you, the United States, Marines, and Navy, had not allowed my parents to get on board that ship and come to the South to begin a new life. Well, that's the story. So was it cool? Yeah, it was cool. And I think, you know, we're the good guys. We're the good guys. We forget that sometimes. Yeah, we make mistakes once in a while. And that's what I try to make, you know, the Marines of today, you know, we're not perfect. But they have a legacy to live up to. I mean, this is, you know, you can't just check out. I mean, once you get the title Marine, you're in. Now, you can be excommunicated from the church. I'm not sure you want to do that. But for you and me and everybody else, you know, everything that's ever going to be written or posted or blogged about us or said is going to say, former Marine, Mike McNamara, and then there's a space. That's yours. You control that. You own that space. And it was a Marine officer, commanded Alpha Company, 3rd LAI Battalion, deployed multiple times, is the preeminent COC watch officer in the history of the Marine Corps. I'm just sucking up to you now, Matt.
No, that's straight up true.
Fairly accurate. I knew you would agree with that.
And,
you know, and had a family, two sons that are Marines, you know, did this, started Marines, you know, Marine Radio, and I mean, and that's your space. You own that space. And it's all good stuff, and that's what it should be. And but everybody, every Marine out there gotta understand it. They own that. No one can take it from them. They can give it away. No one can take that space from them. But yeah, that's cool. I mean, the museum does great stuff, and I haven't seen the new film in the IMAX theater, but I'd encourage everybody to go there. We don't know as much as we should know about our own history.
Talk to me real quick about Guadalcanal and then your visit to the 31st MEU. I'm a parent. I want to ask you about, we had a big discussion here about helo dunker training and had Marines who had been in helicopter crashes write emails saying that the force of the impact, you know, knocks you silly. And then, you know, then you fight for your life and a lot of surviving is luck. It's the, I'm almost like the God who governs the flight of metal through the air in combat, why it hits you and not me. And a very interesting conversation, but one thing that kept coming back to is, relative to that crash was, and I know that there's been no investigation released, but the fact that the Osprey doesn't tend to roll, and also the HEADS bottles that is in every life vest. So weave that trip into a few minutes, would you? Guadalcanal, and then going out to see the 31st MEU, and then commenting on helo dunker training, if you wouldn't mind.
So we were going to take a trip to go to Guadalcanal as part of the 75th anniversary of the Marines landing there. I think it was August 7th, 1942. I hadn't been to Hawaii to talk to the Marines out there about, I just hadn't been out there in a while to talk to them about, you know, my normal pitch about what's going on in the Marine Corps and where we are, and then also to talk about social media and make sure that everybody's aware of what the standard is and what the rules are and what we have to do as Marines to get ready to go to war and all that. So the trip was planned, and then when the event happened with 31st MEU, we modified the plan. So the plan was to go to Hawaii, to Guadalcanal, to go to Australia to see the Marines up in Darwin, and then go to the Philippines, see the Marines in southern Philippines, and go to Manila, because I was going to visit the Philippine Marines and had a chance to go there, and then we were going to Guam for a short stop, and then we deadheaded. We woke up the last day. We flew from Manila to Guam for 3 hours, Guam to Hawaii, took a shave and got off the plane and changed crews and then flew straight back to D.C. So it was, I'm still dragging a little bit. But anyway, so the Guadalcanal thing was really cool because the battlefield and the ground there is pretty much untouched. I mean, they had the there had been a monument built above Point Cruz on some high ground there, and there was a big ceremony, and there were some veterans there, and Coast Watchers, all the nations, and Japanese were there, and everybody laid a wreath at this monument that was built by a bunch of donations. And then we went to what was originally called Edson's Ridge, later called Bloody Ridge. Went up there as a Marine Colonel, Colonel Edson, who was Red Mike Edson's grandson. So we had a tour guide, so that we landed at Henderson Field when we anyway. So we spent the night and we did all this stuff. And so we went up there, and you can see the positions. There's barbed wire out in front, and the ground a lot more defoliated. I mean, there's a lot of farming going on. A lot of the terrain, I think, is probably much less restricted. It's more grassland, but you can see the terrain. I mean, it's not a real big battle space, because when they landed there, it was an uncontested landing, and then they occupied the space. And in Edson's fight with the Raiders and guys from Engineers and Amtrak's was in September of 42, and then they, you know, General Vandegrift's COC, which was in a cave, was like about a click behind him. And so the Edson held that position, and the next day the Marines got up. The guys were back, like Edson's cook and everybody else, all the classic cooks, bakers, and candlestick makers got their weapons. 03 Springfields, they didn't have M1s. There were Army units there. People forget there were Army units. So this was a joint fight. And they then rounded up. You know, Marines got together in small groups, and there were some Japanese around, and they went up and finally ended up taking care of them. But the next big fight was in October, 24-25 October, when 1-7, commanded by Louis Jesse Puller, was occupying that ground, and Charlie Company 1-7 was at the left end of the line on the boundary between an Army battalion that was on their left. I mean, there were other fights down on Chenaru River against 1st Marines, and General Clifton Case was the CO of 1st Marines. I mean, you got all the players. You got Vandegrift, you got Cates, you got Hannikin, you got Puller, you got all these famous Marines, Twining, Edson. Geiger was the commander of the Air Forces. All these Marines that went on to distinguish themselves later in the war and then become, you know, senior leaders in our Marine Corps. So we were able to walk down the ridge, and then the bottom, pretty steep finger, and you get down to the flatland, and there's where John Bassel's position is. He stood. I mean, you still see the hole. And then you read the citation, you know, him and I mean, everybody was either killed or wounded, back and forth, the resupply held his position against the Japanese company. And basically, you know, had to get up and go out in front of his position and clear the bodies away to maintain his fields of fire. He and a couple other Marines fought there all night long. I mean, so to go to that ground, stand there, and see, you know, you still see where the barbed wire was strong, you still see where the trip flares were, there's brass and stuff, and there's probably a huge amount of unexploded ordnance on that island. Although, you know, they're still looking and trying to make it clear because the locals are trying to farm the land. But it was, and it was pretty cool. I mean, often you read about it, you hear about it, and
right. to see the hole, for God's sakes, you got to be kidding.
I know we did a video from there, and I know General Eric Smith, the division, did a video from there.
Right.
I mean, they got it marked off. You can't go like stand in it, but they've got it taped off. But you stand there like right next to it and look at it.
Wow, that's cool.
So I mean, and there was a guy there, you know, the Sergeant Major Jacob Buzo was one of the Solomon Islanders. You know, he was captured by the Japanese, and he ended up becoming a scout for Vandegrift. There was actually a local guy there who was 110 years old, they had demonstrated. We did. They did a ceremony to honor all the Coast Watchers and all the Solomon Islanders who had acted as scouts. This guy was 110 years old. Was there on the island when the 42.
Wow.
And took a picture with him. I mean, he's in a wheelchair, but I mean, the guy, you could tell just by looking at him when he was a young man, he was a stud.
Tell me about going to the 31st Mew and then
comment on
the Hilo Dunker thing.
So we modified our trip and went out to see the Marines on the Mew just because I wanted to go out and see them. So we talked to the officers and then we had a town hall and a flight deck. And let him know that, hey, look, you know, tough situation. You know, sadly, you and I have, you know, we've seen death. A lot of these young men and women have not.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of emotion with that. You know, like you said, why them, not me? You know, why am I here? How can I, you know, I'm angry, I'm upset. Okay, I got it. Been there, done that. But right now, you got to focus. You got a mission to do. You're doing high-risk stuff. You're in the part of the world where if there's four plus one, three of the five are in where you live. You got ISIS, you got terrorism, and you've got two major potential adversaries, so you better bring your A game every day. On the event, I'm not going to talk about what happened because it's still under investigation. A couple weeks earlier, I actually been at Parris Island, and I'd been to San Diego earlier, and I always go to the pool because, you know, it's interesting to watch the recruits going through the training, and I've been getting lobbied hard by the Marines that were on the swimming program that, you know, we need to do a better job of continuing our swimming. And I said, okay, that makes sense. You're a Marine, right? You're supposed to be able to swim. And how could you be a Marine and not be able to swim? You're going to go to sea, you need to be able to swim. Maybe we should add swimming to the cutting score. Maybe swimming should be like rifle, pistol, PFT, CFT. Swim, martial arts.
Right.
Why not swim? There's some issues with that, like pools and availability, and how do you do swimming when you're on independent duty or a B billet? I think you can do it. I mean, once you get a certain qual, if you're a really high swimmer, I don't think you need to go back every year and validate. But if you're not a good swimmer, shouldn't you have to go back every year and try to get better? So that was all going on before all this happened. So on the Hilo Dunker, you know, we've got them at the major bases. The folks are on the Mew. When they're on any sort of deployment, where they're going to be a frequent flyer over water, we do everything we can to get them through the dunker so they get the training, they get the experience, know how to work the HEADS bottle. Because the HEADS bottle came out, we've had these, you know, it's high-risk stuff.
Right.
You know, how to melt the gear, how to wear the life preserver, how to secure your stuff inside the airplane, how to make sure you can get out of your stuff. You remember when we were in Iraq in 2006, remember Jim Dolan and his guys went in the water up in Haditha Dam. We had another Army helicopter went in out by, believe it or not, way out there by Korean Village.
Yep.
We had the tank fall in the water down there by the chicken coop in Karma.
Yep.
We had a lot of people out here. You are, people think it's in the middle of the desert, and we got people going in the water. And so we had to, you know, relearn some stuff. So we're looking at all this, and it would be better if we could learn without having bad stuff happen. That's kind of the goals. So we're gonna look at this, what happened and how the event happened is separate, but we're back looking at, okay, what we're doing, how we do it. But I will tell everybody that's listening, somehow we're gonna figure out that we're all in it. It would have nothing to do with this, but this just reinforces it. We got to make swimming more of a core competency for every Marine, just like it is, like PFT, CFT, rifle, pistol, martial arts.
Will part of that be, I got two more things I want to talk about, so you have to restrain yourself in your answers. That's just my
answer. You're telling me to restrain myself? You never restrain yourself.
That's me, though. We're not talking about me. We're talking about you, okay?
Sure, so, you're in charge.
No, your guys give me rigid timelines, so I need you to show some discipline. Do we have enough Hilo Dunkers? And because we have civilians involved in it, and this is from the former 1st Marine Division gunner, Mike Musselman, it limits us because the contractors are 8 to 5 people. And, you know, if there were Marines running the dunkers, we could do that all night. And we could have the throughput and the reps that were required by the frequent flyers to make them competent. But when you have limited throughput, you know, and you have so many people, you're somewhat limited. And do we have...
That's a fair question, and I'm going to have to dig into that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think we ever... I mean, when do you ever train too much?
Right, never.
We're always, you know, everybody's, you know, one thing you asked me about, what do I worry about, and I'll be brief. You know, when you and I were growing up, you know, we were gone for 6 and back for 18. Now we're gone for 6 or whatever, and we're back for 12. And in that, so we've got one-third left, and this is not an excuse, this is a fact. There's 1,000 reasons for failure, not a single excuse. But, you know, we've got less time to get ready. So we're always, you know, you're always trying to figure out, you know, what are you going to focus on? But this is important. So, you know, do we have enough? Is the contract limit us? I mean, if the contractors are the only ones qualified to do it, but then I got, okay, where am I going to go get, you know, if each Hilo dunker's got 10 contractors we got 8 Hilo dunkers, you know, where am I going to go get those Marines that are qualified to do that? Plus, I want to increase the pool. So, to answer your question, yeah, I think we're meeting the pre-deployment requirement. You know, we get 6,000 people through the 5,000 pack requirement, so we're getting people through it. Is it 100 over 100? I'll go check, but my sense is we're now, you know, as much as we try to get 100 over 100, there may be a couple that don't get through. Should we use more reps? Yeah, I'd like every rifle company to run range 400. 3 times, but
right.
They usually get 1 shot. Yeah. So, but I'm going to go back. I mean, that's a fair question. I'll go back and look at the contractor thing. Not to get rid of contractors, but expand the contract to get more time.